The Titans of Trial podcast is sponsored by the Florida Justice Association Research and Education Foundation, promoting the study and understanding of Florida's civil justice system and how its preservation benefits consumers, victims, and all Floridians. Learn more at floridajusticeassociation.org.
From the Florida Justice Association, these are the Titans of Trial.
From gas tanks to steering wheels to tires to objects inside of cars to safety belts, airbags, all of these things came from lawyers pushing and pushing and pushing as they began to understand what was causing injuries and accidents that could be avoided.
Mike Idson talks about his trailblazing career in product design defect cases and what it was like working for trial legends Bill Coulson and Bill Hicks.
And when I walked in the first day, the auditor or the secretary says, well, how much money did they say that they were going to pay you? And I said, I don't know. We didn't discuss that. And she said, what do you mean you didn't discuss it? And I said, I would have paid. You don't understand. I would have paid to come here to learn how to be a lawyer from these two men.
And about one of the key lessons of his career, about fear.
You don't settle a case cheap so that you can avoid trying the case and the risk that you'll lose that case. You cannot let that influence what you do. You have to do it based on what you believe about that lawsuit and not the fear that you'll lose the case. Because I guarantee you, every lawyer you've talked to is going to hurt because of the cases that they lost.
Welcome to Titans of Trial, featuring the personal stories of the men and women who've made a difference to the practice of trial law in Florida. I'm Paul Jess, Executive Director of the Florida Justice Association. The Coral Gables firm of Coulson, Hicks, Idson was instrumental in the development of personal injury law in Florida. With its roots in firms with legendary founders such as Perry Nichols, Bill Coulson, Bill Hicks, J.B. Spence, and others. So it should come as no surprise that Mike Idson has had the success he's had and continued the momentum of the firm's founders, his mentors. Mike was one of the first practitioners of the law of strict liability in tort. He helped change the standard used in product design and liability cases in Florida, and eventually many other states, and literally wrote the textbook on it for other lawyers. Cars are much safer today, thanks to Mike Idson and those who followed him. His achievements earned him the Florida Justice Association's Al J. Cohn Lifetime Achievement Award in 2013. Mike Idson sat down with Florida Justice Association radio host Harvey Bennett in July 2018 to share his mentor's lessons and his own on personal injury law, the importance of empathy, and the special influence his wife has had in his career.
Mike, you're probably best known for your work on some of the largest automotive recalls in the country, including the exploding Ford Pintos and the Firestone ATX tire recalls, and you've tried and won with your partners the very first Ford Pinto defective fuel system case. Back from the 70s, I remember that. That was a big news story and a case with a huge impact.
Yes, it did. It went a long way towards making cars safer. It started a trend. There were a lot of lawyers that were watching that. There were lawyers that were working together and providing information to each other to understand why this was happening. Why were these cars bursting into flames from a rear-end impact? And what we were able to do is we uncovered a lot of defects in the design of the Ford Pinto. And we had the good fortune at that time to try the first case that in the country that found that the car was defective and unreasonably dangerous. That was kind of the standard for this. And it was what we call 402A Restatement of Torts, gave us the right to prove, to win the case based on the argument that this was unreasonably dangerous under the circumstances in the way that it was designed. So we call that a design case. And that was taken to the Florida Supreme Court and sustained. That case was then followed by a lot of other cases around the country involving the Pinto. And eventually the Pinto was recalled, and they made substantial changes to that fuel system. And not only that, they made fuel systems much stronger, much safer. And that That started in the Ford Pinto case. We held it up so that people could see that they could recover in a case like this, and we made manufacturers see that they had to make cars safer. They had a sign they put up when they had an expert testifying in that case. I'll never forget it. And they asked him, what were the factors that went into consideration for designing the Ford Pinto? They were laying the foundation. He was going to testify that it was safe. And we got the chart, and the chart had 10 different things on there. You know, we want to make a car that feels comfortable and solid, a good mom car. And there were all these different things. We want a hatchback. Safety was 10th.
Wow.
10th, last. It was on the list, but it was last. Well, you can imagine all the fun we had cross-examining him. You put safety down here at the bottom of the list. That's the way we think that they were looking at safety back then. The National Highway Traffic Safety Administration with Ralph Nader had really just started in the 60s. Those regulations, which were minimum standards, those went into effect in the late 60s. So we're talking 1974, 75 is when we tried this case and discovered this case. So we're almost the same time that the government is finally looking at these cars. And car deaths per mile have substantially decreased. Cars are much safer today. And if you look at that, lawyers and lawsuits are involved with almost all of the safety changes in cars to make them safer. From gas tanks to steering wheels to tires to objects inside of cars to safety belts, airbags, all of these things came from lawyers pushing and pushing and pushing as they began to understand what was causing injuries and accidents that could be avoided by simply applying safety engineering to the design of those cars. And I wrote a textbook on that and gave lectures all over the country about how to handle that kind of case. So we got great lawyers in Texas, Colorado, California, and some of those lawyers, we started an organization called Attorneys Information Exchange Group, which exchanged information that we learned about those cases. And so people like in Missouri, good friends of mine, they went and they won their cases and they took those cases to their courts, and their courts established that law for that state.
And that Ford Pinto case really helped develop your track record of cases with not only automobiles, but tires. You were very heavily involved in that national tire recall, Firestone ATX tires, the Firestone 500s.
Tires.
And the Toyota case, the Toyota.
That's a good point. Tires are just part of a car. When we were investigating, I was the national lead counsel on the Ford Firestone multi-district litigation in Indianapolis, Indiana for 8 years. Beginning, wow. I was co-counsel, then I became lead counsel there, that did over 100 depositions and did discovery of Ford and Firestone into the tires and the cars. And what was happening is the tread was coming off of the tires unexpectedly, causing the cars to go out of control and roll over. They would many times leave the highway. You could not control them without a tread. It would be a drag on that wheel suddenly. At usually highway speed, the cars would crash, and we had a lot of people had died, over 1,000 people, and a lot of very serious injuries. They were happening all over the South and a lot of foreign countries. We had 20 of those that we handled from Venezuela, for example. And they all had the same defect. Okay, well, those were designed together. In our opinion, they were designed together. Firestone made a tire for that car. So they're really a unit. That was our argument. Ford tried to say they just gave them performance parameters and it was all Firestone's fault. Firestone said, no, Ford was involved too. So that helped us a lot, the fact that they seemed to be sort of blaming each other for this. But what we really found out is that they both knew what was happening here. And it's sort of the same way with Dakota that makes airbags. We're finishing that case right now.
It's big.
Dakota makes airbags. We found out that they were using a dangerous propellant in those airbags that were causing the airbags to be dangerous to the occupants if they were deployed. They sold those to 12, 13 manufacturers. Manufacturers tried to say they weren't involved in the design, didn't know that propellant was being used, did not know its properties, and part of that lawsuit was proving, yes, you did. You either should have known or you did know. And therefore, you have some liability too because Dakota turned out to be bankrupt. So we were involved in litigation with all the manufacturers that bought those Dakota airbags. So in all of these cases, or many of these cases, you'll have several manufacturers involved. You have tires and cars, you have airbags and cars, and you'll have other products where you have one manufacturer making a component that you think is defective, and then you've got another manufacturer that makes the car, that makes the whole product and sells it.
You're a University of South Carolina undergrad and Emory Law School grad. You've been practicing since 1971. Product liability, we've talked about the cars, we've talked about the tires, but medical malpractice has also played a big role in your firm.
Yeah, it has. Actually, I started here in 1974 at this law firm. So I've been married 50 years, and I've been at the law firm for 44 years. That's a pretty boring life, and I guess in some ways. Our firm was one of the first medical malpractice law firms in the state. We had the first $1 million verdict in the state of Florida here in 1967. That was won by Bill Colson and his partner at that time, J.B. Spence. They had left a firm. They took that case. They won that case. That case became very, very important to our law of Florida. Went to the Supreme Court of Florida. We've had a lot of cases like that, a lot of very important cases to the development of liability law. Hall versus Talcott was the name of that case. And that established the law that if you had an expert witness testify that there was a deviation from the standard of care, you could not grant a summary judgment in that case if the doctor was qualified on that subject. And that's what Bill Colson had done. And that case went to the Supreme Court, and that became the most important, I think, decision in medical malpractice law. When I came here in 1974, as a young lawyer, to be a trial lawyer. I wanted to be a trial lawyer. I wanted to go into a courtroom. We were heavily into medical malpractice. The product liability was newer than that. We were starting both of those. We were involved in the early stages of both of those, but we had a lot of big medical malpractice cases, and I handled dozens of those cases. For the next, even today, up to today, I still handle medical malpractice cases. Involving, everything from neurosurgery to orthopedic surgery to obstetrics and gynecology, you can name it.
What is it that made you want to get into law in the first place?
The competition. I was an athlete. I don't know, a lot of lawyers aren't a requirement, but I know that competitive zeal was part of being a lawyer. I've been accused of being relentless and tenacious. So I was a miler. I was a middle distance runner. I was good enough to get a college scholarship to the Atlantic Coast Conference and captained my college team and set a bunch of records. And so you never give up, And so you train to get to be the best that you can be. And you get to be very competitive about that. You have a training procedure and a process. And you do the same thing putting that case together. Now, the law part where you're in a courtroom, I don't think that I wanted to do that. I think that that competitive urge that you've got helps you be a trial lawyer. But I think I had great mentors, and that's where I developed the ability to present the case in court. I went to two of the best. Bill Colson and Bill Hicks were legends by the time I went to work for their law firm.
And the law firm you're still with today.
It's the same firm, and I'll tell you a story. I went in to see Bill Hicks about the case, about the job. There was a good lawyer, and for some reason, that lawyer decided he wanted to found his own law firm. And they said at the time that they weren't going to change the firm's name. It was Colson and Hicks. And so I said, okay, I can deal. So a friend of mine called me up, Chris Searcy, who's a very well-known lawyer here, and he said, this guy's left Colson and Hicks, and it's a great law firm, and Colson and Hicks are great lawyers, and you ought to go interview for that job. I was in another place at the time. So I did, and I guess it was something they liked about me, and they offered me the job, and I took it. And when I walked in the first day, the auditor or the secretary says, well, how much money did they say that they were going to pay you? And I said, I don't know. We didn't discuss that. And she said, what do you mean you didn't discuss it? And I said, I would have paid. You don't understand. I would have paid to come here to learn how to be a lawyer from these two men. And so I consider anything I get to be a bonus. And then she went and told Bill Hicks that story. He laughed his ass. He laughed about it. Right. And he said, okay, he's going to work for free. Fortunately for my wife and I, they paid us. Okay. But I knew exactly what I was doing when I went to work for those two people, that I was going to learn how to practice right and in an ethical way. And I don't think I've ever had a case overturned on appeal in all the years I've been practicing. I don't think I've ever had a bar complaint filed against me. I think I learned how to practice not only professionally, ethically, but I learned how to practice right, how to treat the judges right and the other lawyers right. Nobody's ever had to tell me, stop yelling at the other lawyer. Because Bill Colson and Bill Hicks showed me, more than they taught me, they showed me how you're supposed to conduct yourself. And that's very, very important in being a lawyer. It's not about being a fight in a sandbox. It's about conducting yourself in a certain way, in a professional way.
Can we assume that you honed your trial skills by watching them and then practicing yourself?
Yes, I honed my trial skills by reading everything I could find, but mainly by watching them, reading their work product, reading their depositions, seeing how they gave final arguments, seeing how they talked to the judge, and seeing how the judge talked to them, and I wanted to know how they talked to the jury, and how they talked to the experts, and how they talked to the other side, the lawyers. Because you want to do it, you know, one of my complaints today is there's not enough civility. And so back then, or at least the way we still practice is, you treat the other side as equally professional. You're supposed to follow the rules. You're not supposed to cheat. Everybody wants to go to the edge and take, you know, get that edge they want. But we have rules that tell you how you're supposed to practice, and you're supposed to follow the rules. You'll win. If you have a good case, you'll win the case. You work hard, and you apply everything you've got to it. I apply everything I've got to try to win the case.
Besides Mr. Colson and Hicks, were there other influences in your life to prepare you for law?
Yes, the person that's the most influential person in my life to prepare me for anything is my wife. I met her when she was a nursing student at the University of South Carolina, and I was fortunate enough to meet her, and she graduated first in our class. I knew that she wanted to practice, and she was a nurse because women went to nursing school. And so after I finished law school, I asked her whether she was happy. She had gotten a master's degree in nursing and was working in nursing administration. Are you happy doing that, or would you like to do something else? And she said, I'd like to go to medical school. So 2 years after I started practicing law school, she went to medical school, and there were 6 women and 170 men. That all changed today. Today it's probably 58% women and 42% men. So after that, she became a pediatrician, and then she became an endocrinologist, and she became a professor of medicine. So we would talk about the cases, and you say, well, how did you handle medical malpractice, and your wife's a doctor? She did hers and I did mine. But she, you know, I knew I had to do something to make her proud. And I knew I had to do it in the right way. I could not embarrass her because she had high standards, okay? And so I wanted to make her proud. And so I know that that's the person that to me is the most influential. My father certainly is influential. He taught me about hard work. He had a restaurant. He worked every single day. He had 6 children. He raised them. He spent 5 years in the military fighting for our country. So I was very, very proud of him. But he didn't know that much about college. I was the first kid from my family that went to college. But he was very proud that I went to college. And he was even prouder I got a scholarship to college.
40-some years later, what's the most rewarding part of being a plaintiff's attorney for you?
The most important thing I think anybody can say is that they leave the world a better place than they found it. That's something that you should keep in mind. It's a good principle that you should think about every day. I've had disappointments in my career. Every time I lose a case or don't get the result that I hope for from my client, that's very disappointing. But I have an attitude that you have to put the things that happen behind you. And you learn from them, but you don't dwell on them. I'm Bob Montgomery, who was one of my mentors.
Oh, yeah.
Bob told me, and one of the best trial lawyers I've ever seen, told me that you have to hate to lose, but you can't be afraid of it. And what he meant by that is you can never back down from a fight. And you don't settle a case that should be tried. You don't settle a case cheap so that you can avoid trying the case and the risk that you'll lose that case. You cannot let that influence what you do. You have to do it based on what you believe about that lawsuit and not the fear that you'll lose the case. Because I guarantee you, every lawyer you talk to is going to hurt because of the cases that they lost. And so I would say your question was, how do I feel today about all these years? And I think what I can say is that I've helped make this a better place. More importantly than that, or just as important as that, is I've represented so many people that deserve to have a good lawyer to represent them, to seek justice for those people in a court of law, to uphold the law, to help do my little bit, my little grain of sand in the big American civil justice system. That's the honor, is that I've had the privilege to be part of that for the last 44 years.
You mentioned tenacity a few minutes ago. Would you say that is the key to your success?
I think it is a very, very important part. I don't know that that is the most important thing. I think if I was making a list, and my partner did, of the 10 qualities of being a trial lawyer, and he used this, Bill Colson, he wrote this for the American Association for Justice, which was called ATLA at the time. And Bill went all over the country teaching young lawyers, because you got to remember, this firm started, Perry Nichols, who was Bill Colson's mentor. Bill Colson was my mentor, and I practiced with his son for 40 years.
Wow.
So this is a very small group. Perry Nichols, in 1948-49, founded the American Association for Justice. There was no national organization that made sure that the courthouse doors would stay open to people who had a civil claim. A lot of these laws that were developed that allow people to recover today were developed as a result of those decisions that were made when Perry did that with some other lawyers around the country. They were just starting. They had to go up. They had to learn how to do this and then how to develop fair laws. So Bill Colson started it in the 1950s. In 1966, he was the president of that association. So Perry was the first one. 16 years later, Bill was the next. 40 years later, I was the next. And 10 years later, Julie Kane, who my partner down the hallway, served in that job. So that's four people, from the first one to the last one, that our firm has been involved. Nobody else has done anything like that. I don't say that with hubris. I say that because we have enjoyed doing that. We've thought it was important. So that is something that's been passed down from generation to generation. And part of that is what we just talked about just a minute ago about what we've done. We teach people how to practice and how to act. And we try to protect people who are the victims of wrongful acts.
Mike, along those same lines, you've been a big supporter of legal education. You co-endowed the Kessler Itzen Trial Technique Program at your alma mater, Emory University, that all second-year law students go through. And also, you developed a foundation by the same name at Emory that helps two women each year go to law school. Tell us more about legal education and why it's so important to you.
Okay, the legal education is the underpinning for the whole practice. If you don't educate somebody how to practice trial law, they won't be a good trial lawyer. I don't think it's something you just learn by yourself. So I learned because I came to work here, and Bill Colson believed in it. He learned from his partner and Bill Hicks. And Bill Hicks was one of the first presidents of the Florida Justice Association. And I told you that Bill Colson was president of ATLA. That's all the lawyers that practice this in the United States. At that time, there was about 30,000 people. By the time I became president, there were 40,000. Both of these organizations have huge trial technique programs. They teach you how to practice in general, how to practice trial law, how to make an objection, how to present evidence, how to cross-examine different types of people and so forth. In other words, do everything that's involved with the trial, with a case from the time it walks in the office to interviewing somebody, and how you get facts and how you put them together and how do you understand the law so that you can apply those in a courtroom so that you can make an argument to the judge and the jury and win the case, and then how to affirm that on appeal. That's what's involved in being a trial lawyer. So you learn how to do that.
And a great way to share documents that you've discovered. And depositions and groundwork that you've laid.
And that other people laid and they share with us. Mm-hmm. And that's an important part of being a trial lawyer. In fact, the Attorneys Information Exchange Group was founded in a product liability field. And what's the word in that? Attorneys Information Exchange. We're sharing it. That's the exchange part.
Yeah, because often there's hundreds of...
We don't charge for it. We just give it to each other.
right?
What?
And often there's hundreds of lawyers on the opposite side.
Oh, they're all
opposing
specialized.
You. Right. Talking about being a good trial lawyer, how helpful or hurtful can self-reflection be?
That's one of the 10 that I would tell you that would be on a list of a quality that a good trial lawyer should have. And that's the ability to learn from your mistakes. If I'm defining self-reflection, it would be, what did I do that worked and what did I do that didn't work so that I can apply it again now in the future, so that I can apply it to be a better lawyer, so that I can apply it to win the next case, to help me identify something that I didn't think about until I lost this case because I didn't think about it.
This is a very tough profession. What are the secrets of your day-to-day success in running a firm?
Okay, one of the things you said is tough, and it is tough, but don't ever forget that you're dealing with people. If you're not dealing with people, if you're a lawyer that's writing contracts, maybe you don't. You're dealing with people, but you're not dealing with somebody who's had something happen wrong to them, something physically wrong with them, or their reputation. It could be, that's a libel and slander case, but we handle libel and slander cases. In other words, they're hurting. They're hurting, or their daddy died, or their child died. That's the worst. When you're talking to them on the telephone, don't forget that this is the only case that they've got. You may be sitting here looking at 50, and this is just one little case to you, but it's the only case that they've got. And they're the ones that are living with the fact that they lost their child. You're just representing them. You have the easy part of this by comparison. They're the ones that have the cancer. You're the doctor that's trying to help them with it. A lot of lawyers don't remember this. And they develop a bad relationship with their client. Most people will tell you that they don't like lawyers. A lot of people will tell you they don't like attorneys, but they like their attorney.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's because a lot of attorneys understand what I'm saying right now. But I think young lawyers need to understand this. They come and they walk in the door and they hand you the whole thing. Their whole future is in your hands right now. You have to take that. You have to be very, very serious in dealing with them about that. You have to be kind of an amateur psychologist in a way.
Well, I was going to say, are we really talking about empathy?
That's, we need more empathy right now. That's one thing that we need is more empathy.
Is there one of those cases that you've had, one particular case you'll never forget?
I have so many cases that I'll never forget that I couldn't begin to tell you. The girl in the Ford Pinto case, Sandra Havlick, in that case, had been hit from behind by a car that wasn't paying attention. She had 17 operations. She was 17 years old. When she would walk into a building, people would turn their eyes because she looked like an alligator. Her skin was like an alligator. Her face was completely destroyed. And by the time, she was the most beautiful person in the world by the time we finished handling the case, because she was so strong. And she could deal with this. So Sandra, she was one of the first ones.
You've been a longtime board member of the Florida Justice Association, an Eagle member, yeah. Very generous supporter, Al J. Cohn Lifetime Achievement Award winner, among others. How has your involvement with the Florida Justice Association impacted your career?
The Florida Justice Association has been essential for my career. In some ways, I don't think I would have had a career without it. There's nobody that's more important than the people who provide the time and the resources for the Florida Justice Association to this career. I wish everybody felt as strongly about this as I do. Some people take a free ride. Other people understand it. They get it. And so when we have an initiative that's going to wipe out something, that's going to wipe out a certain type of practice, we will stand up, rise up, and fight that together, arm to arm. And that's the only way we can win.
And you're constantly having to fight those battles.
We're fighting that battle every single year in Tallahassee, Florida, and in Washington, D.C. Everybody that's involved in the Florida Justice Association is doing that to one degree or another. They also teach you how to be a lawyer. We talked about education. So they protect the legal system. They're involved with selecting judges so that you can practice law. They're involved in funding the system, the whole civil justice system. In other words, building new courtrooms, making sure that the most modern equipment is in the courtroom. So there's a lot more than just representing clients involved with being a lawyer.
Mike, how do you balance your professional life with your family life?
I work about 7 days a week. I'm involved either in a community activity or some sort of thing with my family And I'm involved, but I think I'm involved in something that I'm doing professionally every single day. And my wife for 50 years has been aware of that, and she respects it. She works with me and understands it. So I think how you balance it, you have to remember that there's more to life than work. There's one thing you don't want that you'll never see on anybody's gravestone: I should have worked more. Okay? You'll never see that. In fact, it'll be the opposite. I should have worked less. I should have spent more time with my family. I think it's very, very important to your mental health that you remember that lesson.
What about regrets?
I have my biggest regrets that I haven't spent more time with my family, and then I don't have more time.
What's your view on the future of the legal profession? Do you have any concerns?
I do. I have looking concerns that people take things for granted, and that when I've been talking to you because about all the things that I do. Okay, I'm not unusual for people my age, who've been doing this for a long time, who believe in this profession. They understand you have to give back. They have to give back. You can't just be taking things all the time. That's part of being a good lawyer, this profession of being a lawyer. One of the concerns today is that people aren't trying enough cases. Back when I first started, we used to try 10 cases a year. We'd try 6 cases a year. As the cases got bigger, you couldn't try as many. But I would say you would try 4 to 6 cases a year. Most lawyers can't do that anymore. There's something called mediation. When I started, there was no mediation. If you didn't settle it with a defendant, you went to trial. That changed in the 90s and later, where you got professional mediators that would bring the two sides together, and the judge demanded it in every single case. So you got to hear the other side's case before you ever went into a courtroom. One of the things that makes you settle a case is hearing the other side's case. And then having a person who's not involved in it talk to you about the weaknesses in your case and the strengths in their case, that understands what the case is worth. That's a mediator. We didn't have those people. So that guy or that woman over there that you were litigating with and you would get your ego involved, and you wouldn't see the strengths of their case, and you thought you were going to win every case, and you'd go to court in too many cases. The good side is we don't try cases that we ought to settle today. We don't waste the court's time. And that way we don't lose a lot of the cases that we used to lose. The bad side of that is so many of these young lawyers don't see the inside of a courtroom enough. So they don't learn that part of being a trial lawyer. And that's a critical part of being a trial lawyer, is the ability to go to court. What ultimately settles the case is your ability to go to court.
We've talked about the law. Let's talk ethics.
Okay.
Do the ends sometimes justify the means?
No. The ends do not justify the means in legal practice. And you have to understand what the means are, you know, because sometimes, like I said before, you have to go up to the edge. You have to know where the edge is, okay? You can take every advantage that the law allows you. That's the means to win, which is the end. But you can't cheat. One of the things that young lawyers many times don't do is they don't understand the ethics code. They've never read it. It's like they don't have a course on it in law school. The ethics code is something that you're required to read by the Florida Bar. It's a part of the Florida Bar Journal. And I would highly recommend that that be part of your legal education.
Mike, how would you like to be remembered?
I would like to be remembered as a family man and a mensch. A mensch is a word, you know, that's a sort of a Yiddish word that means somebody you have respect for. They say, you know, that was a real person. That was a person who understood the things we've been talking about. That's what I would like. I haven't earned it, but I would like to have that one day, because I think that sort of encapsulates the whole thing, that he tried hard and did his best.
Mike Itzen, you are a titan of trial. Thank you.
Thank you.
This is Paul Jess. We hope you enjoyed listening to this Titans of Trial episode. If you're not already a member, we'd like to invite you to join the Florida Justice Association. Please visit us on the web at floridajusticeassociation.org, or drop us a line at radio@floridajusticeassociation.org.
Thank you for listening to this Titans of Trial podcast, sponsored by the Florida Justice Association Research and Education Foundation, promoting the study and understanding of Florida's civil justice system and how its preservation benefits consumers, victims, and all Floridians. Learn more at floridajusticeassociation.org.